kind of lost myself for a minute there. In 1963, I know a good number of us will remember that, Henry John Deutschendorf Jr. dropped out of Texas Tech University. He'd been studying architecture, but he left that behind to go to California and try to make himself a music career. 6 years later, Deutschendorf's song Leaving on a Jet Plane became a number one hit for Peter, Paul, and Mary. And that same year, Deutschendorf signed on with RCA Records. By the mid-1970s, Deutschendorf was an international superstar, having successfully won over country, folk, and pop audiences. His songs spoke to the hearts of people who hadn't necessarily lived his same experiences, but could find resonance with their own. For example, one didn't need to be a country boy to thank God for his circumstances, and one needn't have loved a girl named Annie to learn these words by heart: "You fill up my senses like a night in the forest." His breakthrough album, Poems, Prayers, and Promises, released in 1971, was his fourth album. The chorus of the title song from that album went like this: "We talk of poems and prayers and promises and things that we believe in. How sweet it is to love someone, how right it is to care, how long it's been since yesterday, and what about tomorrow? What about our dreams and all the memories we share?" He sang about the simple things, talking around a campfire, sunshine on his shoulders, and country roads, and before we knew it, all of us were singing along. When he died in 1997, people from all walks of life mourned the songwriter they knew as John Denver. It's a very long way, geographically, chronologically, and culturally, from the music of John Denver to the sermons of the Apostle Paul. But these two men had one important skill in common that made them both excellent ambassadors. They both had the gift of meeting people where they are. John Denver's songs appealed to hippies and soldiers, to parents and children, to feminists and farmers. Paul the Apostle's preaching found its mark with Greeks and Jews, men and women, socialites and slaves. We have an excellent example of this in Acts 17. And before I read you this sermon in Acts 17, it's important to know that Paul reached Athens only after a great deal of adventure. And several of the experiences that Paul had en route to the 17th chapter of Acts were less than friendly. Paul had a way of ticking people off. We find that earlier in Acts, Paul went into Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews, and Acts reports that Paul went in, as was his custom, and on three successive Sabbath days, he argued with everybody. He explained and tried to prove that it was necessary for Jesus, the Messiah, to suffer and rise from the dead, and he said, and this is the part that didn't go over so well, "This is the Messiah, Jesus, whom I am proclaiming to you, who you killed." This argumentative Paul managed to win some converts to the way of Christ, but he severely angered the Jews, who didn't like being argued with and talked down to. In fact, the Jews came together to form a mob, set the city in an uproar. They were so angry at Paul that they followed him to the next city and incited the crowds against him there too. So when Paul was given an opportunity to speak in the Areopagus in Athens, it seems that he realized he needed to tone down his rhetoric a little bit. It seems that he understood that he would be talking not only to Athenian philosophers and commoners, but also to Jews. If he wanted anyone to be able to hear him, then he needed to speak their language. He would have to meet them where they were. And they were everywhere. The Greeks, especially the philosophers and the politicians, lived in their heads. They were the ones who argued for and against the divine by saying things such as, and I'm not making this up, God is the which, W-H-I-C-H, God is the which, than which there is no witcher. Now that would have turned me right around. The Jews, however, beheld God in their hearts through their collective memories. For the Jews, God was not the which, but the who. The I am who I am that led them out of slavery in Egypt. Preaching at the Areopagus, Paul meets the non-Jews first. You're going to hear this in a minute, so see if you can hear this. He met those non-Jews first, the Athenians who were living in their heads, who celebrated cool logic and rhetoric. He doesn't denounce them as pagans or heretics. He just welcomes them as people who though they don't know it, are being drawn into the heart of God. He starts out by acknowledging their shrine to the unknown God and rather criticizing them, praises them for their spiritual curiosity, for their gesture towards God. He quotes their own poets and their own philosophers who have written about God. So here we are in Acts, the 17th chapter, verses 22 through 31. Then Paul stood in front of the Areopagus and said, Athenians, I see how extremely religious you are in every way. For as I went through the city and looked carefully at the objects of your worship, I found among them an altar with the inscription, to an unknown God. What therefore you worship as unknown, I will proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, he who is Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in shrines made by human hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything. Since he himself gives to all mortals life and breath and all things, from one ancestor he made all nations to inhabit the whole earth, and he allotted the times of their existence and the boundaries of the places where they would live so that they would search for God and perhaps grope for God and find God, though indeed God is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, for we too are his offspring. Since we are God's offspring, we ought not to think that the deity is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of mortals. While God has overlooked the times of human ignorance, now God commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will have the world judged in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this God has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. So you can see there, as Paul draws the Greeks further into his story, he begins to bring his Jewish listeners along too. Paul speaks of the God of Israel, the God who made the world and everything in it, who's Lord of heaven and earth. And then he brings the Jews even further along as he speaks of the God from whom one ancestor made all the nations to inhabit the whole earth. And the Jews listening know this ancestor as Father Abraham. Only after having found this common ground as Paul began to share the gospel, the part of God's plan that neither the Greeks or the Jews are familiar with. He begins to tell them about God's unfolding plan and how the world will be judged by a man whom God has appointed and whom God has raised from the dead. Paul is sharing the gospel. He's pointing the way to Jesus Christ, but he's making sure that the people he's addressing can hear him. It's kind of like a 20th century songwriter. Paul meets the people where they are. He bridges the gap. He shares what he knows in a way that maybe they can come to know it. I'm afraid this lesson is one that we, and by that I mean Christians, and by that I mean in the United States, we fortunate ones with educational and potential and freedom of all kinds sometimes forget these lessons. Rather than approaching those with whom we have religious, political, or philosophical differences with kind words, with encouraging words, with simple words and universal images, we come at them with threats and mandates and ultimatums. Many of us come at our teenagers with words like abstinence, as if they can go back and start over. We won't speak the language of safe sex and condoms and STDs and HIV. We make ourselves irrelevant to the poor, speaking the language of investments and tax cuts and insurance premiums, when their minimum wage, less than a living wage, isn't enough to require taxes from them. And insurance premiums are part of a world they're not living in. In our prisons, we often speak the language of retribution over redemption, and at our borders, we meet people who have risked their lives and left their families. We meet them with guns and laws rather than resourcefulness and hope. We sometimes forget that the purpose of finding out where people are is so that we can meet them there. Instead, we tend to think that the only reason to find out where people are is so that we can emphasize how far away they are from us. We would do better to retrain ourselves, to remember, like John Denver and Paul, to meet people where they are. Consultant Eddie Hammett published an article entitled "Traditional Churches Responding to Busy Lives, Discipling Busy Adults." And one of the observations that he makes is meeting people where they are rather than where we would like for them to be is a biblical model, but it's very tough to practice. His article leads us to ask, where do we need to meet people today in order to have a real opportunity to talk to them about our faith and to share with them the gospel of Jesus Christ? Ursel Harrison, who's a progressive Baptist Christian, uses Paul's example in Acts 17 to lay out four places in which we could meet people where they are. First, he says we need to meet people where they are spiritually. This means not only comprehending what they know, but what they've experienced, both positively and negatively, in their spiritual journeys. This week, I talked with a young trans woman who's been daily at the Texas Capitol, and she was inspired by seeing the people, not just people just like her, but more people just like her. But even as she reveled in this new discovery, she was battered over and over by the anti-trans rhetoric. And she knew where that was coming from. Anyone holding an anti-trans sign or shouting an anti-trans slogan was probably a Christian. We need to learn to speak to her as LGBTQ Christians in a way that can transcend those experiences. Simply saying we're different to people who say, I'll never try a church again. Simply saying we're different is not going to cut it. Trust must be built over time. And little of that time may occur in worship, maybe none of it. But instead, it will be spent in the city, the Areopagus, at the Capitol, on the streets, at the rallies. Second, we need to meet people where they are geographically. We call ourselves a church without walls, and we take seriously our desire to offer welcome to people without expectations, but the other half of welcoming people in is regularly going out. We need to make sure that we are continuing to get out to habitat builds and pride festivals and AIDS walks and foster parenting classes and disaster relief efforts. Each time I see one of you wearing an Uprising t-shirt, I'm happily surprised. I was thinking about that this week when I was out and about, and I was thinking about my wonderful button that we have, and there are plenty more for you. You are safe with me buttons. And I was thinking, the only place I really wear mine is at church. And I need to make sure I get another one and carry it around with me so that people see it out in the world. Third, we need to meet people where they are developmentally. People who have different life experiences than many of us need to be considered. Sometimes our life experiences are so different that it seems we can never find a common language. And in those cases, we need to communicate through what we do and who we are, living out the gospel. Emmanuel Celestine Suhard says, "To be a witness to Christ, to be a witness does not consist in engaging in propaganda or even in stirring people up, but in being a living mystery." This is my favorite part. It means to live in such a way that one's life would not make sense if God did not exist. Sometimes we forget that Christianity is countercultural, y'all. It's revolutionary. It's messy. It's on the fringes. We forget that at our own peril. It waters us down, weakens us. Fourth, we must learn to meet people where they are culturally. When Paul went to the Areopagus, he didn't go unprepared. He knew he would be talking to people who were unlike him in many ways. But he found places of common language, common literature, and common questions. Now, I know some of you are starting to get uneasy because this sounds just a little too easy. So let me say to those of you to whom these words sound like an abdication of morality or theology, I am talking about meeting some of these people where they are, but hoping and working and praying not to leave them there. I'm talking about taking a page from Paul at Mars Hill. Even as Paul found common ground and met the people where they were, he held firm to the truth as he knew it. To the Greeks, he said, "Lest you misunderstand me, this is not all about wanton hedonism and atheistic rituals. Our God, God of heaven and earth, desires your repentance, desires that you live good and meaningful lives, desires that you know and follow the one that is risen from the dead and who preaches love. I'm going to meet you where you are. But I'm going to care about you enough not to leave you there." And to the Jews, Paul said, "It's not enough that you recognize the God of Abraham. You must also open yourselves to the one sent by the God of Abraham. You must understand that no longer is it enough to carry out right practice. You must also believe in the one that God sent. Welcome the Messiah, the Christ." The warning here is that we will never be successful in meeting the people where they are unless we first meet Christ ourselves. We can't share good news that we don't know. We can't share transformation and salvation that we haven't experienced ourselves. It rings false then. We must meet people where they are, spiritually, geographically, developmentally, and culturally. And finally, we must remember this simple truth. The only person whose behavior we can consistently change is ourselves. I'm so angry all the time. These days, I am so angry all the time. But here's what I've realized. When I am the angriest, it's because I'm focusing on the people with whom I'm angry. Not on Christ. Not on myself. What we focus on grows. What we feed thrives. So here are some things I'm going to offer you for when you get focused on those with whom you are angry. There's a lot more to this. You've probably seen these posts on Facebook. I'm just going to give you some examples. When you're angry with anti-trans rhetoric, focus on pronouns. I really care about gendering people correctly, but I'm not fluent yet in pronouns, especially for those who prefer they and them pronouns. I'm pretty good at saying, I'm sorry, and correcting myself, but if I focus on it, I bet I'll get to the point where I don't need to correct myself very often. Because I'm focused on the pronouns, the things that matter to other people, not focused on those who refuse to use them correctly or even try, but focused on my own use of them. When I get focused on gun violence and those who don't seem to be interested a bit in doing something about it, I can use anti-violent language. I'm not saying this is the key to it, but this gets my attention back on myself and my actions. I saw this week. Focus on anti-violent language. Instead of saying, we're going to pull the trigger on this, say, we're going to launch this. Instead of wondering, did we jump the gun on that? Say, did we start too soon? Another way to just flip things around. I read about a woman, I told you this before, who said, I'm going to stop apologizing so much this year. I'm not going to say I'm sorry all the time for being who I am, and I'm going to look positively at things. So instead of saying, I'm sorry I'm late, I'm going to say, thanks for waiting for me. Instead of saying, I'm sorry for rambling, I'll say, thanks for listening to me and trying to understand me. I'd love it if you'd share with me more examples of ways to do this, getting our focus back on our own behaviors and on Christ-like behaviors. And I'm going to end with this, a quote from Carrie Niewolf. This sums it up so nicely. The world has enough cynicism and resentment, and the church should be an alternative to the ways of the world, not a contributor. A dying church focuses on judging the world. A thriving church focuses on building a refreshing alternative to the world. May it be so. Amen.